But I just want to speak. This is not a speech. It's not another talk. But I would like to say something for about 3 minutes about this project called The Merciful Impact. Is more or less everybody who wishes to be in here here? There may be many who want to stay outside. Here's Anne, and there's Ethan. Okay, I'd just like to say a little something for all of you who've come to this wonderful reception on the penthouse. It's very hard to get here because the elevators are not coordinated properly. There's already, there are two people, there are 47 people trapped on the seventh floor. But I wanted to say this about that, about this project. These talks were given at All Saints Episcopal Church, Chevy Chase, Maryland, which is was once a really, really, what used to be known as a prominent Episcopal parish in the United States, and like all those parishes, was coasting on class, and yet well-meaning class. And it had a terrible time that was exacerbated by internecine culture conflict because of the Episcopal Church culture wars. And it seemed to me in January of 2008, having just begun all of the Carpenters, that the thing to do would be to talk about those things which struck me as most Christian about Christianity, which are the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount, and they're mainly on the Beatitudes. And so this is a series of 8 Dean's classes or talks, the kind of thing I would do here in Birmingham, about the message of the Sermon on the Mount to suffering, failed personalities. And these talks sort of disappeared. I didn't even remember I'd given them. And some people listened to them and liked them a lot. Can anyone here tell me the only Hollywood movie ever to actually quote the Beatitudes directly? It's called Robot Monster. It was made in 1956. It's the famous science fiction movie with a gorilla who's wearing a diving helmet. You recognize it. It's the only Hollywood movie to quote all the Beatitudes. And David Babicow here from the Panhandle of Florida liked the talks and wanted to get on board with them. And so he worked with David and Ethan and others, Mr. McDavid,
yes,
and myself, to find a way to put these out. So these are 8 talks about the Sermon on the Mount. Now, why are they important? Why is the Sermon on the Mount important? They're important for 2 reasons. The first is not as important as the second. Aldous Huxley, of all people, says in a book he wrote in 1945, called The Perennial Philosophy, and he was not a Christian, although he'd grown up in the Church of England, had gone to Eton and had all that, but he'd gone, as we said today say, he'd moved in a different direction. He said a very, very powerful thing. He said that while the Reformation did a great deal in the world to destroy the power of superstition, the religious conflicts of the 16th and 17th centuries in Europe were so intense that when, by the time of the end of the Huguenot Wars, the 30 Years' War, most particularly, and the English Civil War, and finally the Jansenist, Quietist controversies in the Roman Church in France, Christianity in Europe was essentially dead because, he wrote, by their fruits you shall know them. Now, that in fact, we think of Europe as always being Christian until about 1930. You know, it was basically until the First World War. That's not true. Christianity, it became extremely secular among the educated elite in Europe at the end of the 17th century for only one reason. That's because Christians had somehow got into a distortion of life to be tearing each other apart. Remember the song by, who did the song Love Will Tear Us Apart?
Joy Division.
Love Will Tear Us Apart. And it took John Wesley and the preaching of grace to bring Christianity back into people's hearts in Europe. They weren't Christians who just went to church in the 17th century. Christianity was in a terrible way in the late 17th century, and that's why we have Ben Franklin, you know, and Thomas Jefferson. Well, what I want to say about that is that the message of grace is absolutely urgent because of what's happened in the Christian culture wars in the United States. Now, I know, I'm speaking as one who's both burned and been burned. I'm not speaking out of some judgment. I stand under the judgment, but this I know, and I knew it when I got to Chevy Chase, that I had grown up there, and where the Episcopal Church was the thing in Washington, D.C. I would then, in 2008, go down Connecticut Avenue with my collar on, and people almost all looked at me funny. Because of the result of the culture wars, mainstream Christianity had a sour face. And I realized that, obviously, we had allowed ourselves to go down a terrible dead end in which the ministry of the law and condemnation had become the bottom line, and we had lost ground irretrievably, at least in Northwest Washington. Now, I say it because, so that's why these talks, I had to give them there. Because we were, because of the divisions that we found, especially in the in connection with the Ohio election, you know, and all that, and I'm not making a political statement, but the divisions that Christianity was seemed to embody in the public mind had discredited the Christian movement for huge numbers of possible people who could use the message. So that's why what's happening at Mockingbird is really urgent, and I'm quoting from Foreigner. Urgent, remember? Urgent.
Emergency.
You can probably see the whole thing. She's a wonderful backup rock and roll. One of them used to call them the girls. Now, what that means is these were preached in the immediate aftermath of a destructive conflict that had reduced church attendance in the Episcopal Church by 25% within 4 years. And that's not an exaggeration. It's probably higher in Philadelphia. Now, so these talks are an attempt to rediscover the Mockingbird origins of Christianity in the grace and love of God, which satisfies the wrath of man and the justice of God. That's point one. But that's not the really important point. The really important point is if we do not understand within ourselves the nature of love, which is love without judgment, we lose our children. And this is my most, this is the point I really want to say, this is what I'm really interested in saying. One of the most shocking things about being in ministry and following people through many years is that mothers and fathers have enormous identification and attachment with their children, always, in all departments of life. And these attachments and desires to transform and shape their children almost always backfire. Yes. And I'm constantly with older people who are now in their 60s and 70s who say, "What happened? I love my daughter. I gave everything to my son. I just knocked myself out. My whole life is wrapped up in my children." Usually that's the word that I hear. And I've lost them. You know, the plain fact is, my son always seems to want to get off the phone. You know, he calls me, but I get this vibe that he really is uncomfortable talking to me. Any of you have recognized this? Polly, you're the son. Or my daughter says that she loves me and she's undying in her care, but there's, I can't quite, someone came up to Mary yesterday after her remarkable talk about grace means detaching or unidentifying with your grown children. And it's, for a mother especially, it's very counterintuitive because mothers are built, the children is an extension. And this woman came up, a wonderful person, and said, "Mary, if only I'd heard this talk 50 years ago." Yeah. And just think about yourself. Think about your relationship with your mother and father. And what happens is parents, with the best of goodwill and with the most sincere love, end up having sort of a glom on to their children as sort of having a plan for them. And the children become a project. Have you ever been anybody's project? It's really great, isn't it? You know. And what happens, if you have the desire, if you want to, if you want your child to turn out a certain way, that is the sure recipe for their, if you actually take hold of your child's persona, that is a sure recipe for driving them to Anchorage, Alaska. That really is true. Maybe there's someone in your family. You know, I used to do this, and people say, oh, you're just talking about the Jerry Springer Show. And I say, you don't understand. You do this all the time. We would do funerals. And at funeral, I'm talking about here. I'm not talking about in Westchester. At funeral after funeral after funeral, one of the children wasn't there. I said, well, what happened to them? You know, didn't they hear? You know, or are they sick? Well, we just don't talk about it. We haven't talked to him for 14 years. And maybe you know, any of you have a brother or sister who you haven't talked to for a while? Well, you probably don't, but I've known a few people who have a brother or a sister. And what happened is, inevitably, if you talk to that person, they will tell you that my mother or my dad meant well. They did it out of love, but they absolutely, totally smothered my sense of personhood and being. And I sort of had to lie and head for the hills. And I see this so often. Now, in the conference, we call that the law. And if you've ever had a father who really, really was hard, but unhappily there are many such fathers. Again, you don't have one, but you know somebody who has a hard father. A lot of mothers, you know, these helicopter mothers, I would say this in Chevy Chase, and of course they loved it. I would say, to the degree that you text your college-age daughter, to that degree she's having to go underground. You will never know the real fact. If you text her 7 times a day, you are going to, in your 70s, you're going to come to my successor 3 times down the line, and you're going to say, what happened to my daughter? This dream of family life. And you go to people's houses, and they have pictures of their families when they were in there, you know, back when they were, the children were all little, and it's all glorious and wonderful, and they're all, you know, just fantabulous. And they're all AWOL. In the parents' 70s. Now, don't raise your hand, but does anyone have ever seen that? Well, this is why these talks are urgent. They're only urgent for cultural war reasons, if you're interested. But they're urgent for your family, for your children, because I'm telling you this, if you don't understand the difference between law and grace, if you yourself, by the grace of God, should have children, you will wake up in your 70s and you will say, what did we do wrong? Because I lost them. And of course, when you say, well, they weren't yours to lose, you know, that sounds horrible. So you can imagine how wonderfully received I was by the Young Mothers Fellowship. But you see, I'm trying to do you good. But they didn't believe me there. But I know that many of you do. The message that Paul Walker was talking about horrible David Browder dying, getting into the thing, you know. the reason that's true, it's not a conceptualization. It's true about your family. And if you don't understand that love is not about possession, and it's not about transformation, and it's not about an agenda, and it's not about shaping somebody, you will lose the child of your loins forever. So that's why I got a kick out of giving this message about Jesus' profound meditation on the nature of love. So I hope you'll buy many of them for the sake of Mockingbird, and I hope you'll find them helpful and healing and even urgently staving you off from decisive errors in loving. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you.